Tennessee just sounds perfect. Whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, this is Annie.
And Samantha.
And welcome to Stuff I Never Told You, a production of iHeartRadio. And we are taking a brief sojourn, a brief break from our religious trauma episodes, although we are going to be talking about religious trauma in here. Yes, it's we are.
I think it's shaped a lot of the counterculture of where we are today, essentially.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, a lot of us have those stories, and I know we're going to talk about it more in our religious trauma series, but I specifically have a moment of like sitting in a friend group where everyone was recounting being afraid of going to hell as a child, which is quite a thing. Yeah, I do think it has shaped a lot of discourse. So we are doing our book club a little bit early. Content warning for suicidality, abuse, sexual assault, trauma. And I would say specifically trauma, but also queer trauma specifically and trans trauma specifically. So keep that in mind. Again, we're not going to go too deep in any of that, but there are themes throughout that we are going to be discussing. So take care of yourself. If today's not the day, come back another day. If it's never the day, then that's okay too. But we are talking about something I think was really important work. And that is I Hope We Choose Love, which was a 2019 collection of essays and poetry that was written by Chinese-Canadian Kai Cheng Tom. And it's largely about their experience being a queer person of color. Also, quick note, we saw Tom's pronouns as she, her, and she, they, them. So if we got that wrong, please write in and let us know. We decided to go with they for this, but yeah, just let us know. It was a quick read. It's very honest. It's difficult. It's moving, but it's hopeful. It's really hopeful. And it tackles difficult topics with a level of nuance that is often missing. It is a thoughtful critique about community, especially the queer community, and the importance of voicing these critiques in a meaningful way and having these honest conversations. So I really enjoyed it, and it made me think. It made me think about a lot of stuff. And so highly recommend. I read it very quick, but it stayed with me because I was thinking about all that stuff. Tom also wrote a children's book called From the Stars in the Sky to the Fish in the Sea. And they also wrote Fierce Femmes and Notorious Liars, a Dangerous Trans Girl's Confabulous Memoir, and other things as well. But their work is highly acclaimed and awarded. It's got some like really cool, really cool awards attached to it.
Also, they are a social worker. So, you know, we'll call that and counselor. And of course, I also have to call that out. So they do a lot of work that does some introspective level of feeling themselves and their trauma and how they worked with it as a social worker. There was a lot of depth that I think was there. That's so personal, but very clinical. Love it.
Yes, yes. I did think about you throughout a bunch of this. And also, this one is a quote-heavy one because we don't have the experience, the lived experience that Tom does to talk about a lot of this. But I will say a lot of it resonated with me, not just as a queer person, but also because Tom talks a lot about like being a public, being someone in public talking about these things. Talking about social justice and what that looks like. So there was a bunch of it that I was like, yeah, I've been thinking about this too.
They do a great job in bringing in a different perspective for specific things that I thought I had a handle on that I was like, oh, yeah, that's that could be damaging, even though the intention is good. Mm-hmm. It's not great for different communities. I was like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really good. It's really good. So let's jump in. Here's how the book opens. As I write this book in the spring of 2019, it has become something of a truism among my community of queer people of color that the end of the world is nigh. A wave of right-wing and openly fascist governments have been elected to power across the world. Wealth and power are increasingly concentrated in the hands of the brazenly corrupt few. Climate change and mass extinction are ravaging the earth, largely unacknowledged by those with the political power to do anything about it. As for those communities of queer people, racialized people, disabled people, marginalized people that have been taking back their power, the social justice activist that raised me to believe in the possibility of a revolution that would change and save the world, sometimes it seems like the most painful cuts of all time come from within my own community. Call-out culture, lateral violence, puritanical politics, intimate partner abuse, public shaming. We know so much about trauma, but so little about how to heal it. What would community know about saving us from the apocalypse?
Yeah. I feel like they really ask some deep, hard questions and pointing fingers inwardly. So not only to themselves, but to those they would consider friends and their family. And I think that's such a great, dangerous, but a great perspective, because you do have to start really looking at your own social group. And if it's become toxic, are you willing to confront it? And they seem to, I think they do a great job with that. But yeah. Okay, so let's jump into another one. They said, not only was I in pain, but my pain was publicly known, scrutinized, gossiped over. People, mostly queer and racialized people whom I didn't know, sent me emails and Facebook messages that were thousands of words long, asking for intimacy and attention and occasionally threatening me when I didn't acquiesce. Journalists asked me for interviews about my private life, my sex life, my family, my mental health. No topic seemed to be off limits. I was stalked in real life and online. I became terrified and paranoid. I stopped trusting people and this thing we called community. I stopped trusting myself. All around me, the people I loved were also in crisis, psychological, financial, medical, interpersonal. When you live in a community of queers, anarchists, and activists, crisis is the baseline and stability an outlier. Among trans women, a life expectancy of 35 is the norm.
Yeah, and that's like going to what Tom does talk about being kind of in this public space and having to deal the mental toll of being open and dealing with these topics when trans women have a life expectancy of 35. Like, you know, when you're dealing with it personally, and it is important to talk about. And I was kind of talking about this, obviously my experience is not the same, but I was talking about this with our book recently, where I was like, you know, people, and I really appreciate it, but people keep kind of, you know, congratulating as I'm writing the book. And I'm like, when they asked me what the experience was like, I was like, well, I was crying like every weekend we did it. Because it was the topics we had to talk about. Like,
right.
And again, those are important topics to talk about. They're necessary. They're critical. But it's, we can't pretend there is not a mental toll of
right.
it.
I mean, that's definitely when we were doing the books, when we were doing a difficult subject, mm-hmm. you and I check in with each other often when it's something we know is personal because it does. It takes a level of intimacy and vulnerability to lay this out and trying to sound like an expert at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting because they do talk about being a pseudo-celebrity, like a celebrity within their own community. And then what kind of ownership do they have versus what their audience has when they are the ones that are on the front lines, or when they are the ones that people see as a representation, like what is owed and what isn't owed. And also, being in activist mode, being in crisis mode. I've talked about it with social work all the time when I said I went to therapy, but I could never get to the root of what was happening, of my trauma, of anything, because I was putting out fires of the crisis that I was constantly in because of my job. And even with this, there's less. But there's also different types of like crisis that I feel I'm in with this. You and I talk about this often when we talk about the fact that we're overwhelmed, or we're overwhelmed that we're not meeting expectation, or that there's a level of, there's a level of ownership of by the audience, by the listeners, and that we owe that, owe you, the listeners, something. And it's not the listener's fault at all, but there is that whole level about, okay, accountability versus ownership, about being told we have to do these things. And because we are in the public eye, we have to do more to be cautious. That puts us into the point of being so anxious that we can't move, that we freeze instead of actually doing anything, because we're so scared of making the next bad move or being called out, as they say. And they talk about this a lot. I'm sure we're going to get into it, but about people falling off of pedestals and then being harassed and pushed to the extreme that they feel like they have to give up or change over. And of course, again, it's not to say it's someone else's fault, because if they decide all of a sudden they're a TERF from being, you know, an activist in the trans world, that's a whole different conversation that they probably always was there. But that level of being harassed and bullied instead of being given a chance to grow and learn.
Right. Yeah, we are going to talk about that more. And I would also say, Tom talks about that too, of when you're in any way marginalized in any intersection within that, in our mediascape landscape that is still largely, you know, white men, white people, then journalists come to you for this. And so then that's like a whole extra level of pressure, because you're getting more asks for these kind of, these very painful stories or questions. And that is an issue here too.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Tennessee just sounds perfect, whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands. Not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly boring since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC. All right, here's another quote. So in the midst of despair, I have come to believe that love, the feeling of love, the politics of love, the ethics and ideology and embodiment of love is the only good option in this time of the apocalypse. What else do we have? I mean, love that is kind, but also honest. Love that is courageous and relentless and willing to break the rules and smash the system. Love that cares about people more than ideas, that prizes each and every one of us as essential and indispensable. I mean love that is compassionate and accountable. I mean love that confirms and reaffirms us as complex and fallible, yet lovable anyway. Love that affirms us as human. I want to live in love and believe in love. If I have to die, I want to die in love. This whole world might be coming to its end, or it might be in the midst of an enormous and terrifying change that leads us to something better. Either way, I want to go through it in love with the people I love. And this is how it opens again. Like it really is. Comes out swinging. But I wanted to include it, and there's another quote where I'll talk about this a bit more, but I love this idea of like love as honest and kind. Like it's not just love without questions. It's love with like, how can we all be better? Here's something I see with you. But there's also a really great quote later where Tom writes something about like, where you can have the feeling you can confront somebody and they won't leave. Like because we're so afraid of confrontation, we don't have it. But if we could like trust in this love of like, we need to talk about this. We need to have this confrontation in a healthy way, but you won't leave because of it. And why right. The trauma of being in a marginalized community makes that so much harder.
Right. Absolutely. And that to get into that marginalized community, you feel like you have to work. And mm-hmm. they talk about that you're not mm-hmm. just welcomed. You have to work to be in there, even though, and to prove it. But at the same time, they talk about the fact that also sometimes we don't ask for people to work just because they identify as something. So that's just as wrong. So there's so many layers. So
yes.
Yes. And yeah, speaking of layers, we're going to get into the themes. Again, this is all quotes probably because they do a great job in talking about it. As a memoir, they've already thought about what they're trying to say. So to try to rephrase is silly. So we're going to do a lot of quotes with our own experiences or thoughts with it. So here's one about religion. Deep down, I have always believed that I'm a bad person and that the world we live in is an awful place. Maybe that's just what happens when you grow up an effeminate boy, secretly a trans girl, in a Chinese, Canadian, Christian-ish, not religious enough to go to church, but enough to use the threat of eternal damnation as a motivator for household chores, family with class trauma, and inherited mental health issues, you know? As you know, yeah, and this is right along the lines when we talk about trauma, and we haven't talked about it yet. This is an upcoming episode where we talk about the hellfire and brimstone era of the circuit pastors that brought that in. Of course, Paul also did that. You don't know how I feel about Paul.
Yeah,
it's gonna be a theme. But yeah, it is, and I think it's again for an Asian woman myself, adopted. It wasn't the fear of hell. It was the fear of disappointment and not being grateful.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, but that fear is what, this is why I can't hate on Christians that witness, and that by witness, I mean trying to get you to convert to Christianity, is because they truly believe if they don't convert you, you mm-hmm. are going to suffer in the afterlife and they want to save you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a teacher tell me in eighth grade, it's like I'm watching you run off a cliff and I just want to save you.
Right. Damn. Well, I had a similar that thing happen with my boss when I was like 32. What's happening? 35. But yeah, I think that's obviously the very beginning of them trying to figure out who they are and knowing that they weren't. Meeting, they were never going to meet the expectations of their family.
Right.
Yeah. So going on is, they say, fast forward to me in a hospital bed in the psych ward after my suicide attempt at 16 years old, still thinking the same thing. Double fast forward to me at 26 in 2017, first typing this essay through chronic pain and brain fog in bed on a Saturday morning, still thinking about the same thing. So in retrospect, it's easy to see how I got into the whole social justice radical queer activism thing. Like most of my peers, all I wanted was to be good, or in the fashionable parlance of various political movements in the past 10 years, quote, rad, down, or woke, like my mental ill transsexual never going to hack my parents' ideas of good. Unlike my Harvard-educated, biodegradable, plasticizer, inventing, engaged to a hedge fund manager, psychiatry resident older sister, but the rad queer community offered me a whole new set of norms for performance and lovability that at least on the surface gave value to the identity factors, you know, transsexual, effeminacy, mental illness, general bad attitude, that had caused me so much childhood shame. Oh yeah, and I was a crazy trans girl of color living in a white, cis-dominant society. Where else could I go? What else could I do? It was a whole new chance to be good, to be righteous, to do good works, and become lovable at last. Yeah. Again, this is like paralleling our talk about trauma, religious trauma. Because exactly what it is, that you cannot meet the standard in one place, so you try to meet that standard in another.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that this book really hammers home, which we're going to talk about some more in a second, but like that guilt and that shame, and religion is so much about, well, my experience with religion, and I think a lot of our experience with religion is about that. It is about like, you're never good enough. You are constantly having to ask for forgiveness. Like, I'm not even Catholic, and I remember asking for forgiveness.
Yeah.
For like things you did wrong. I'm putting quotes around that because I remember doing it once where it was like, I accidentally took this pencil, a pencil, from school. And I was like crying. I thought I was going to hell. Like, it sounds funny, but when you're a kid, you believe this stuff and it sticks with you. It's not easy to get rid of. And so pivoting from that to, you still have that feeling like you want to do good. You want to get rid of that shame that you feel that could lead to this suicidal ideation. And so where do you go if you've lost this community, if you've left this Christian community? Where do you go? And that, yeah, so much of this made a lot of sense to me. Like, of course, like it makes sense they would go into this queer group, into this trans group, because there wasn't, what else was there, as they say? Yeah. And as we talked about already, this part of the book kind of pivots into the being online, being that pseudo celebrity, as you said, the mental cost of making it, as we discussed already, of like, really having to put yourself out there, these really painful things out there, maybe things you're just not, don't want to share. But it also talks about the infighting within the, quote, social justice warrior community. So I have a bunch of quotes about this because I thought it was really interesting. Here's one. Simply put, in social justice land, we emphasize our marginalized identities and downplay our privileged ones to seem cooler and more important and to shield ourselves from critique. Online, I sometimes see arguments in which people try to shut each other down using identities as weapons, e.g., you can't talk to me that way. I'm trans and you're being transphobic. Oh yeah, well, I'm a femme and you're a mask. Shut your misogynist, femphobic mouth. This type of identity politics is based on a level of essentialism that I am uncomfortable with. It assumes that all people of color, trans folks, etc., have the same experience and that identity categories apply uniformly across the board. It also reduces people to a very restricted set of relevant identities and erases the rest of their life experiences while fetishizing the pain of the oppressed. Strategic essentialism, the ability to talk and form groups based on generalities, is an important tool for activism. But the kind of identity politics that discomforts me is not strategic so much as disingenuous and self-serving. It often feels like we are far more interested in diversity or identity rather than diversity of thought. So I want to include some of this stuff because I do think like we said at the top, there's a lot of nuance in Tom's arguments around this. And I think this is one Tom tackles a bunch of stuff we're just not comfortable talking about. Like, there are certain things, of course, like, that have context and that certain people should just never weigh in on. Or either you're the support, but you're never the leader. But there is, we've talked about this too, like the kind of performative activism or not really looking into what someone is saying, just reacting knee-jerk, like those kind of instances of people going after the wrong person on social media because they didn't research anything about what they were so angry about. So it is nuanced. It is not a simple conversation, but it is one we should have because we're not having the conversations we should be having sometimes because of this. Yes. Here's another quote. I am a trauma survivor, kill surprise, and the thought of safety consumes me on a day-to-day basis. I am sympathetic to the need for safety because most of the time I don't feel safe, but I struggle with safety politics when the safety of an individual or group comes at the expense of another individual or group's freedom. Alt-righters like to whine about the loss of freedom of speech to the politics of safety, by which they mean white dudes' freedom to be virulently misogynist, racist, transphobic, ableist. I am more concerned about vulnerable individuals who stand to actually lose social access and bodily autonomy. I am thinking, for example, about queer community centers where I have worked that restrict the access of mentally ill trans women and homeless people because their very presence makes middle-class queers feel, quote, unsafe. Safety is, I believe, an inherently classed, raced, and gendered experience that frequently runs the risk of being used for regressive ends, ironically, for restricting the freedom of the vulnerable, those who are never really safe. Often we see the call for safety actually reinforce the power of oppressive institutions like the police and the prison system in our lives. When we choose safety over liberation, our movements fail. Yeah, I thought that was a good... Again, like it's such nuance in that of the class involved,
right?
And like safety and in these communities that we just don't talk about as much,
right? Of course, again, yeah. Who is what protections are being provided to which groups?
Yeah,
and it's never for the marginalized or those who are in need or being threatened the most.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they talk about that a lot, and has a lot of dangerous side effects, I guess. I don't know. Results to it when it comes down to the lack of safety, but the term of safety. And the same thing is that police were there to protect, but oftentimes they are the aggressors, especially when it comes to the marginalized communities. There's no safety under a police state. We know this.
Right.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Tennessee just sounds perfect, whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise, all things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands. not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly boring since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC. Something else that Tom talks a lot about in this book is related to that kind of performative activism, this sort of performance of virtue and what we talked about a little bit earlier of like you have to prove yourself to be in certain communities, that feeling that you have to prove yourself anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you did it better. All right, so let's get into the quotes. The social justice internet is rife with peer pressure to repeatedly and constantly demonstrate one's adherence to the norms of thought and belief that are currently in fashion. We strive to outdo each other's comments, tweets, and status updates with political critiques and takedowns while using the latest, most perfect, unoppressive terminology. I have heard friends describe this as, quote, activist theater, where goodness is performed and absolution for the original sins of privilege and ignorance is temporarily granted. Yeah, y'all, I feel this to the core, which again is why we don't go on social media.
And that's part of the problem, right? That's part of the problem. But also, I will say too, like this describes, we've talked a lot about burnout within activism and within feminism, and a part of that has to do with what we were discussing earlier around, like, it's hard. It's hard, and a lot of us are not good at taking care of ourselves because we constantly feel like we have to do this thing, right? But if you're online all the time feeling like you've got to outdo other people's comments, tweets, whatever, you're going to burn yourself out much faster and or do what I was just talking about, which is not really understand what you're critiquing. Because mm-hmm. you're so busy, like, I've got to critique it now first.
Right.
And Bridget talked about that a little bit on one of our past episodes we did with her about, you know, you don't always have to have a hot take. There are some things you just, I don't know anything about. So I'm right. not going to have a hot take about it. I can learn more about it. Right. But it's not my arena.
I don't know why you're asking me this. I have no comment. Thank you very much. No comment. All right, here's another one. A lot of public debate has already raged about the benefits and drawbacks of call-out culture in activism, so I won't go too deeply into it. Suffice it to say, a culture in which the majority of political education is done through public shaming is neither all that socially transformative nor psychologically healthy. Yeah, and I think we talked about this in our TikTok episode as well yeah. as previously about cancel culture. Cancel culture, we talked about the fact that accountability is huge and that we need to have that.
Yeah.
However, accountability means learning and teaching. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. this whole call out just to disparage and make fun of, not helpful. I get it.
No.
You're angry and you want just, and this is your form of justice, but that's not.
Right. And I remember in our TikTok episode, we were more specifically talking about like kind of that entertainment aspect of like,
yeah.
I'm looking for any small thing you've done wrong that I can call out without that nuance. Because people should absolutely be held accountable. But there's a difference between doing that and just trying to take people down to get more clicks yourself. So here's another quote. What strikes me as particularly interesting and disturbing about celebrity culture and the social justice movement in its relationship to mob mentality and capitalism, we are happy to take political direction from celebrities within the massed hierarchy of the movement, at once elevating and scrutinizing them. That is, until they say something that we do not agree with. The result is an atmosphere where individuals are not encouraged to engage authentically with the complexities and ambiguities of our politics, either because we are, quote, not important enough, or because we have been raised too high to fall. And yeah, that goes back to what we were saying about, I mean, even as an individual person before I came on the show, I was so scared to post anything on social media.
Yeah. Yeah. I was less scared, but I was also really self-deprecating. And I was like, this is not funny. And some of these comments are ableist. Yeah, that's not okay. I think that's what, because you don't realize you're being ableist right. when you're thinking you're poking fun at yourself.
Right.
And there's so much to that that you really have to think on. But again, it's overwhelming.
It is. It is.
Overwhelming. So they also talk about shame, and they write, shame rules community, and not only the social justice kind, in every tight-knit, ideological-steeped community that I have known, Chinese-Canadian, Christian, queer, shame and judgment pervade. In the social justice movement, privilege is our original sin, and the doctrine is our Hail Mary. The political workshop and the protest are our church, and the organizers, speakers are our priests. Shame and judgment are the twin faces of trauma, and we are trained to see ourselves and others through their eyes.
Yes. And I think one of the things that I remember when I first started on the show that this really resonated with me is that I was very concerned about, like, you are not feminist enough. You have to do so much. You have to do so much. And I was learning. Like, looking back at some of those episodes, I had so far to go, and I still feel like I do, which is not bad. It's good to learn that's the keys, that you don't, like, get stuck in your ways and not listen to people. But I remember I kind of got called out by someone for being, like, not inclusive when it came to people with disability and protest. And so then on a following episode, I made sure to go out of my way and be like, you know, but if you can't do this because of disability or something, whatever. And then somebody wrote in and was like, no, people can do it. Like, and so I just got so in my head about, wait.
It's kind of like the language, because we think we're being on top of things. So when we see specific languages of this and that, and then later, like, this is more divisive. And you're like, I was just trying. You know, we're not trying to play the ignorance or make excuses, but the constant changes and listening to a community is really, really important. And I think that's part of the thing is, like, when you, especially if you're not a part of that community,
right,
being hyper aware is important. Yes. But that level of being shamed to the point that you're just like, I give up.
Right. And then you feel like you can't even mention it anymore.
Right.
But it was also in this case, like, it was more of a, and we have talked about this in several episodes, and I know we talked about it in our ADA episode, but it was more like, it wasn't intersectional, I can say, about the second critique. Maybe I did, I'm ready to believe I didn't voice it in the best way. I'm not shying away from that, but the critique wasn't very intersectional. So, I mean, that's part of it. And that's one of the things I loved about how Tom kind of ended this part was, if it's not inclusive, it's not my revolution. And that is our big, that part of that whole intersectional feminism. That's what we try to keep in mind every time we put together these episodes, is, are we being intersectional? And we do love hearing from you, even if it is kind of a kind of like tap on the wrist. Hey,
right. This is not great. Good.
Right.
And that's the thing. It's like, we are all open to criticism. And when you're teaching us, and again, this is the whole call out versus call in level, and being like, hey, this is what we think. I mean, people were super angry when we first got on and I wrote the definition of the bi community, and they were upset. And I was very confused, because I'm like, I took this off a quote. I don't know what's happening. Mm-hmm. But understanding that that was so damaging, I was like, okay, you're correct. Let's correct this. And we had, like, a wonderful three-part series to it about bisexuality. And I learned a lot, and the amazing people were so patient to tell us everything and to have a sit-down conversation. And it was really real. Like, if they got offended, they said it right away. And, you know, we learned from that very quickly. And I think it's important that we continue to have those conversations. But yeah, it does affect us in the future of, like, oh no.
Yeah.
We will always want to be inclusive, as you were saying, and intersectional. And we also absolutely acknowledge we have not walked the paths of many of the people who have gone through things like this specifically. And so trying to be over the top cautious sometimes silences us.
Yeah. Yeah, we will have a little bit more about that in a minute. I did want to include an example of the poetry, because, again, this has also got poetry in it. It's really, a lot of it's really beautiful and moving. And here's one about, like, you are allowed to leave, about domestic violence. Relationships should never be based on fear. It should never be based on they will kill themselves if I leave. An adult human life is too much for any one person to hold. Repeat it after me. Hold it close to your heart as you walk away, as you grieve the loss, as you find yourself. Leaving is not abuse. Getting out is not abuse. Freedom is not abuse. Freedom is never abuse.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like a lot of people, that hits that.
Yeah. And then I wanted to include this because, again, a lot of this made me think of you, Samantha, a lot of this book. And there was a whole section about validation being damaging and specifically critiquing active listening, which I had heard you critique before. So we have a couple quotes about that. This is probably somewhat true and can describe well enough the situation of a volunteer who was speaking for brief periods to strangers. Playing psychologist and giving half-baked, unsolicited advice to people in crisis is generally a bad idea. Don't do it. But the problem is that this politicization of a rigid, specific form of validation seems to be applied to a huge range of informal situations outside of crisis support.
Yeah, half-baked, unsolicited advice. So they also said, because we question the notion that given choices, people will always choose wrong, or that we would automatically know what was wrong for them. And because often the immediate feedback we get for providing unquestioning validation is very positive, and we fear conflict. 10 years later, I'm still trying to undo my validation and active listening training because I want to listen not only actively, but also mindfully, compassionately, critically, lovingly. And I want to be listened to in those ways by my friends and family. I have come to believe that support, or at least the kind that comes from loving long-term relationships, is characterized by not only validation, but also grounding, containment, authenticity, willingness to enter the space of conflict, as well as the knowledge that we will emerge from it. Sometimes I want advice from my friends, because the truth is, I don't always know what is best for me. I want to know if my friends think I'm doing something wrong. Yeah, absolutely. I got very irritated at a training we had in something, and they were talking about active listening, and I was like, no! No, don't do that! I think I was texting you. I was like, this is bad. I really want to go back and undo everything they just said. Don't do this. Don't do this because you're going to push people away.
Yeah. And this is I felt this a lot too. And this is a hard one to grapple with because you want to support your friends. And I think that's the key, is that it's your friends. If you have good friends and people you trust and people who support you, like honestly, truly support you. There's a difference between that and like some random person or somebody who's not really your friend. But it is hard. Like, at least for me, I really struggle with conflict and I freeze up because of my past, because of some of the stuff that's happened in my past where I do feel responsible for other people's emotional health. And so in that case, the easiest thing to do is to be like, no, you're fine. It's good. It's good. So this is another thing that they talked about that is not easy at all. But it is true. And it has so many layers to it. Because again, like, you don't want somebody who doesn't have your best, who isn't really looking out for you, being the one saying you're wrong. That's different than like a friend you truly trust and will support you.
I think that a lot of these conversations, what we don't realize, just frankly telling someone you're doing this wrong or you need to do this, is not actually helpful in general, even if you are good friends. I think in the most aspects, of course, if you've been going around and round and round a subject and you finally get to the point of like, okay, let's just be real frank, because you've had the permission of finally getting to that point and you understand and you have a depth of knowledge instead of just like the one time you talked about it. A lot of the times for me, if there's something that there needs to be a blanket statement about, is because of, again, the repetitive, like, okay, you've got yourself into a trap. Let's I'm just going to frankly tell you and see what you say. But on most of the levels, is really forming those thoughts as questions, because most of the times when you're saying a statement, you don't know what the answer could have been had you asked the question of, instead of saying, don't do this. It's just more of a, well, what would happen if you did this instead kind of conversation. And I say this because that also validates, instead of being the active, like constantly thinking, being active in listening and meaning, yeah, you constantly interrupt by saying, so you did that? Oh, okay. That's not helpful. That's very interruptive, by the way. It does help you kind of summarize with them. And I'll actually backtrack what they, because they don't often know what they just said. I know for me, in my conversations, that's when I discover something, when I'm actually saying it out loud. I'm like, oh God, I did it.
Right. Yeah.
And that could be just as validating as well as holding someone accountable.
Right. And I think that's a great point, because as Tom said, it's like, it's a difference between being unquestioning validation and being like, wait, let's talk about this a little bit more before. Yeah. Here's another quote. I believe that in our best, most fallible human moments, the urge to overvalidate comes from our fear of crossing boundaries, of replicating the traumas that abusive families and social oppression have enacted on our developing selves. I don't want to be validated. I want to be loved. And I put that in because they make great points about this, about like, again, being in marginalized communities and all of the intersections of that, that fear of confrontation gets bigger and bigger. And because you know what other people in that community face, because you face probably something similar. So like, it just gets very difficult to not have that knee jerk, like, oh no, everything, I'm going to validate you. But it's hard. It's like, it's hard to unlearn that. It's very, for me, it's a very natural thing that happens. There is a lot of discussion about suicidality in this. Here's a quote. And this was a story about Robin Williams and kind of the coverage of Robin Williams after he took his own life. And it was really heartbreaking, but a different... I hadn't really thought about it in this way specifically, but here's the quote. So let us continue to tell stories about suicide, but instead of seizing the stories of others and imposing on them a preconceived understanding, let us listen to the complexity, the tension, the horrible human messiness that come with them. Let's listen to it all and accept that we can never fully understand the forces that drive someone to live or die. So that was sort of about like the after Robin Williams had died, all of the media being like, well, here's why.
All right.
But we don't know. We'll never know for sure why.
And it takes like the spectatorship
of
someone's crisis.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. And Tom goes on to talk kind of more about that, about suicide being framed or used as a political tool, especially for trans women. Quote, the argument around body sovereignty and consent are, to me, clearly rooted in a misunderstanding of what it means to provide care, the action of giving help, and caring, the feeling of being cared about. The predominant white colonial queer trans narrative of proper consent to being cared for goes something like this. Someone expresses that they are in pain, or you happen to see that they are. You offer them help. If they refuse, you back off, no questions asked. Any further attempt to help could be considered a violation. This narrative holds a lot of resonance with me. Both body sovereignty and consent politics come from movements around medical care and sexual/romantic intimacy. But I believe this approach also comes from a traumatized place. It is rooted in queer and trans experiences of abusive families and intimate partnerships in which we were not allowed to refuse. We were not allowed to leave. So our reaction is to swing to the other extreme. We encourage people to leave, and we don't question the refusal of love, even when it is clearly needed. Yeah. So again, that's like a difference between someone you trust, obviously a friend, versus somebody not. But I thought that was also a really poignant nuance.
I mean, I think that line of, if they refuse, you back off, no question. Any further attempt to help could be considered a violation. I think that's something really important to remember, especially when we talk about those who have been assaulted in domestic violence situations. I think about that often, in that push and trying to be like, you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this. And if you do it to a person who is not ready,
yeah,
it causes more trauma. And mm-hmm. also this level of failure. And then you've also put a gap between you and them, and you're no longer someone safe for them to come right. to. And mm-hmm. I hate that because it almost sounds like we're saying condoning a violent situation, but you really, there's nothing you can do. Kind of that talk of like, it's not your fault. Mm-hmm. Leaving is not abuse. Stop, you mm-hmm. know, not saying something is not necessarily abuse. It is that level of like being supportive and understanding their grounds and why they've set them. And though you want to save them, mm-hmm. it's not something that you can take on. And yeah. if something goes wrong, it's not your fault. And that level of like, if they're not ready, you're never going to be the one to tell them they are.
Right. And I think, so many of these things are not easy at all. Because we want to fix. We want to fix problems for people we care about. And it is. It is. It's so hard when you realize, like, I'm not what they need, or I can't put this on me. But also, I love that Tom put this in terms of trauma, of like the queer trauma or trauma for trans people, about why it's even worse. Like, it's mm-hmm. even like, oh, I've been so traumatized by these experiences that I need, like, it's almost the, you know, I'm telling you to leave because you're trying to do something to make you feel like you have any kind of control, but it's coming from trauma. Mm-hmm. When you really do need somebody to help you. Yeah. You know, it's a mess.
It's a mess.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Tennessee just sounds perfect, whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
And here's another quote. In terms of considering trans women's suicide within a trans misogynist social system, I do not believe that, quote, supporting the agency of suicide is actually a legitimate refutation of the social system. Rather, it is the ultimate expression of disposability culture. It allows us to disguise inaction in the face of mass suffering and death in pretense of compassion and radical politics. It is not radical to, quote, support trans women dying when we are already being murdered regularly. It is not revolutionary to simply accept that society is so terrible that trans girls might as well kill ourselves. After all, we are the society that supports trans girls and sends them these messages about whether life might be worth living. It is our responsibility to change the stakes, to offer different options, to keep reaching out and sending the message that we will never stop trying, never stop caring, and never stop loving.
Right.
There's a soul level, and I know they have that kind of back and forth as well of responsibility, but also just giving up and allowing it to be a norm and how disgusting it really is. That is something that, why are we acting like this is a bad thing? I know the disabled community talks about this often when it's portrayed that they would rather die than not do be able to do something else. And it is so ableist and like, wait, I'm fine with this and I can fully function and live a happy life. Why are you saying this? I'm not worth right. living. What the hell is this? And it's kind of that same level of trans people, like the suffering, there's a lot of suffering, but that doesn't mean they don't deserve to live and have a happy life.
Right. And I think there's also, I know some listeners have written in about this, about kind of the martyring right. of people who die in terms of activism and how damaging that can be. So here we have a bunch of quotes about what is one of the biggest themes in this book, which is queer spaces and infighting within queer spaces and why it's so hard to have conversations and serious and genuine conversations about that as queer people. Okay, so, quote, in queer community, we already know why our people die. We are killed by homophobia and transphobia, murdered by strangers, family, and a state that seems determined to deny us any vital resources such as healthcare and shelter. What we do not know is why we hurt each other, physically, psychologically, and sexually. Such is the power of our devotion to protecting the mirage, the glamorous fantasy of our community. We are already so few, and those who would destroy us are many. Life is already so hard, so dangerous. It is easier to turn away, to pretend that we don't see what is happening right in front of us. So yes, then Tom delves into some examples and some numbers around this. So here's some more quotes. For a community that is supposedly steeped in progressive politics, sex positivity, and mutual love, queers hurt each other horribly an awful lot. Nearly half of individuals who identify as gay or lesbian report experience sexual violence or psychological abuse from a partner, and more than half of bisexual individuals experience the same. Similarly, more than half of trans people report having experienced intimate partner violence in their lifetime, and trans feminine individuals, particularly those of color, are much more likely than other groups to experience physical violence and be murdered by their partners. How do you call out the community that took you in when your family wouldn't? How do you call out the people who loved you, whom you still love? The people who taught you who you were and helped you to survive? How do you call out your lovers, friends, mentors, role models when you're not sure either of you will survive? And then, in simple terms, this means that I cannot speak up about queers who have harmed me because that will result in them being harmed. It also means that if I do choose to speak up, they may try to avoid harm to themselves by suing, intimidating, or otherwise enacting more violence against me. Yeah, I think this is such an important conversation to have because it's true. I mean, they also have a whole section where they're talking about sort of the pressure to online tell people about, like, give names of who's hurt you. And it's when you have this threat of violence, when you did, it was the community that took you in after you lost perhaps your religious community or what have you, or your family, and you know what will happen. Like, it's difficult, and it allows for a lot of abuse to go unchecked and untalked about. That whole, like, section about the questions, like, how do you call out the people who loved you, whom you still love? And especially Tom also goes into, like, you know, all of the trauma they faced, which doesn't excuse anything, but we have to talk about what is happening, why this is happening. But it's so dangerous to do so.
Right. And then that's that same conversation of them being the example. Mm-hmm. Society, we know what just happened with that school shooting recently, and it turned to be a trans man. And that's the most, like, that's the immediate right. pit point that they came to, was that yeah. it was a trans man. It's like, we told you they're dangerous. And that's the first time in history? I don't know. I mean, years that has been a thing. That mm-hmm. a mass shooting in general was committed by a trans man. That's not the average. In the entire year, we've had so many shootings, and all of them have been mainly men, cis men, but we don't want to talk about statistics. They become the example, and then they become the boogeyman. And that's a damaging part to society, to that community. And that's what we see also within the Black community. Many Black women don't want to report men, Black men, because they're already going to be criminalized immediately. But the sentence they get, whatever happens, they may die even before they make it inside a jail cell, any of that, or into a courtroom. So the dangers of that alone causes people to not report. I also have a lot of Black women that are like, I don't care. If they touch me, they're going to jail. I love that for them. But, you know, that's that level of conversation that we have. Like, we cannot talk to it. And I know that we're going to keep going, but I think one of the big things, and I really found interesting, this is the part that I found interesting when we talk about consent, when they talk about sex work and consent, because you and I had that book, we were talking about consent and just really talking about enthusiastic consent versus all of these things. And then Tom really brought out the conversation about sex work. Like, it's never going to be enthusiastic consent. So this is damaging, that term in itself, and then when we were turning that notion, is can be harsh. You need to really think about it before you try to apply it to every community as a generic, because that is a very cis, heteronormative, middle-class privilege to be able to say it. And I hate that. I hate that. That shouldn't be a thing. But there's this level of like, wow, yeah, okay. Maybe we need to rethink what we're talking about when it comes to consent and who it applies to and how we should acknowledge the separation that it deserves. But... And then here's another quote about the dangers. There are more trans people on television than ever before, but trans youth remain vastly disproportionately homeless and suicidal. Trans people's visibility has skyrocketed, but anti-trans legislation and discrimination remain rampant. Trans rights are debated more and more frequently in major news outlets, but trans women who are Black, brown, and sex workers continue to be assaulted and murdered regularly. Yeah, that's exactly what's... And this was written in 2019. I would hate to see what their take on all of that today.
Yeah. Well, Tom does have a website where they write a lot of blog posts, so you can check that out. And then I want to include this. Quote, I want to take a moment here to note that white people are always asking queers of color to tell them the ethnic gay story. Was it hard to come out to your family? They ask eagerly, eyes bright with hunger. Are they very traditional, which is to say queerphobic? It is taken for granted that the traditions of non-white cultures are queerphobic. Liberal white people love the ethnic gay story. It confirms their belief in the superiority of whiteness and assuages their sublimated guilt over the queerphobia and racism that are still rooted deep within white-dominant colonial Western society. What the ethnic gay story misses is that the queer children of diaspora are not the passive victims of our villainous, ignorant families, or at least not in the way that white people like to imagine. Our relationships with our blood ourselves are more complicated than that. Yes, I think that going back to the point at the top where, you know, journalists reaching out to somebody like every intersection within, and because of all of these systems of white supremacy and patriarchy, you know, trans women of color, not as many in our media landscape, that it becomes this sort of like, also, as Tom said, this fetishization of your story and all of that stuff. And don't do it. Think about it.
I mean, that's definitely that conversation of, oh, tell me about your culture. Where are you from, really? All of these things. And if you have, like, say, a similar story like mine, they do have this entertainment factor of like, oh, wow, so you were in an orphanage. What was that like? You were adopted. What was that? It becomes this fable, almost cautionary tale of like that whole Cinderella level. I'm like, yeah, I would have loved to found a prince. I want to be rich. but that level of entertainment and something that's really traumatic.
Exactly. Yep. Yes. Well, here is our final quote, which is towards the end of the book. I am haunted. All trans women are. Behind me stretches a line of ghosts, trans women killed before their time by the hatred of a society that does not know how to love us. Perhaps this is why trans women's words are so powerful. In those rare moments when we are allowed to speak, we speak with the voices of those who have come before. Yeah.
honestly, it's a short book, but it covers so much. The few pages that it is, it's about 130, I think. And it is hopeful. I feel like a lot of the stuff we've been talking about is not. But it doesn't shy away from the pain of it and the conversations we need to have. But highly recommend it. Highly recommend it. Well, that's what we have to say about it. Go check it out if you haven't already. As always, if you have a recommendation for a book for us to read, you can email us. Our email is stephanieandmomstuff@iheartmedia.com. You can find us on Twitter at @MomStuffPodcast or on Instagram and TikTok at Stuff I Never Told You. You can also find us on YouTube. We have a book coming out. You can pre-order it now on stuffyoushouldreadbooks.com. Thanks, as always, to our super producer, Christina, our executive producer, Maya, and our contributor, Joey.
Thank you all.
And thanks to you for listening. Stuff I Never Told You is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts on iHeartRadio, you can check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC. Tennessee just sounds perfect, whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.